more. Baby, it's no lie. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make the heaven the middle of it. Grass make the heaven the middle. We are grass make the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
This second hour is a replay of Trevor Loudon's book. It was a speech given in San Antonio a few years ago at Luby's, and it's The Enemies Within. It's very important. So it's a replay, but listen carefully. It's great. Great speech.
Once again, we'd like to give thanks to George Butler and his Live on Location TV folks for coming down from Austin and to cover this occasion. Mr. Loudon is on a book tour. That's why we have books back there, okay? And he's selling his newest book is The Enemies Within, Communists, Socialists, and Progressives in the U.S. Congress. If you want to learn all about it, I think he had to extend his research time and finally hit a deadline to get that thing up to print as it keeps growing. Mr. Loudon is from New Zealand. He's an author, speaker, political activist who maintains a prolific and controversial blog entitled New Zeal. If you've never been to the New Zeal blog, that's a real treat. It's a daily treat on my part, too. His major claim to fame, or where he came to a lot of attention, and of course, a lot of us saw him in the movie 2016, Barack Obama's America. He was interviewed extensively through that and other documentaries that have been done. But his book that's for sale back there in the center of the table, Barack Obama and the Enemies Within, is when he exposed the ties of President Obama to communist and communist parties. His upbringing in Hawaii, and his tutoring by a communist by the name of Frank Marshall Davis. And those probably aren't names that are strange to many of you, but this man is the one we have to thank for bringing that to light. And he's also the one that exposed Van Jones as a communist that was actually a czar within the White House. And we applaud him for that and managed to get that fellow off our payroll one way or the other. But there are many more of them out there. And I would like to ask Mr. Loudon to come up and give us a talk about his books and his life and his research. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Tom. That's excellent. I love coming to Texas. This is the first place I realized I had an accent. Because you might know Brandon Darby. He's a former anarchist out of Austin who became a conservative and now works for the Breitbart Network. And I told him I was coming down to Texas, and he said, "Where's Texas?" And that's the first time I understood that I talk funny. But look, it's an honour to be here. I just want to say, too, it's also great because I've got two Kiwi friends here today. One's Wes over here, who's from Texas, but he met a Kiwi girl and ended up in New Zealand. And Blair over here, who's from New Zealand, I used to work with him in politics, and he met a Texan girl and ended up over here. So it's great to see both of them here tonight. Look, I love coming to this state because America is not a unitary country. America is a federation of independent states, and nobody knows that better than you guys, you know. You are the only independent republic to join the Union, and that independent streak remains now. And that independent streak is one of the great hopes for this country. And that there's so much good coming out of Texas, guys, and I'll be talking about that as I carry on. Now, it's my second tour here. I've been down to the Alamo, and I've felt the presence there. You know, you go into that place, and the only other time I felt that was in a little mission in Carmel in California. You just feel something there, and that something is still with us today. So, look, first thing, everybody always asks me why I should care about the United States. Why do I come from 12,000 miles away to talk about your internal politics? Well, I say there's two basic reasons. The first is simple gratitude. My country was only saved in World War II from invasion by the Japanese armies, by the huge sacrifice of your fathers and uncles and grandfathers in the battles of the Coral Sea and Midway and Guadalcanal. And as Blair will attest, that memory is still strong in my country today. The second reason is related, but it's a little more selfish. Ronald Reagan had it right. This is the last best hope for mankind. If freedom fails in the United States, if you lose your economy, your constitution, and your military superiority, freedom will fail everywhere. If you guys go down, the whole West goes down. If you guys go down, the bad guys, I'm talking Russia, China, Iran, Cuba, Nicaragua, Venezuela, North Korea, and their crazed Islamic allies will carve up this planet amongst themselves. Now, we down in New Zealand, most of us are pretty cocky because we think nobody's ever going to bother us. Way down there where the penguins live, you know. But just a few hundred miles to the north of my country lie the beautiful Fijian Islands. Wonderful place, but the Chinese are now training the Fijian military. They're building big hydroelectric dams on the islands. Fiji is now a Chinese client state, and that's happening right throughout the Pacific. Just a few months ago, the Australian Minister of Defence was in China for talks, and a top Chinese general publicly told him, he said, "Now is the time for Australia to choose. Do you stay under American protection or do you come under Chinese protection? And if you are smart, you will choose China because we are the growing power in the region." Now, he wouldn't have been cocky enough to say that under Bush, certainly not under Reagan, maybe not even under Clinton, but he's confident to say it now because he knows the leadership in your White House and what it stands for. And all around this planet, your allies from Israel to Germany to Britain to Canada to South Korea to Japan to Australia are all basically freaking out because they see that your president loves the bad guys more than he loves the good guys. And that's causing huge instability throughout the world. Israel is backed into a corner now because your president has destroyed all their allies in the region. They haven't got a friend left. And they may have to take desperate measures, measures that might put us into World War III. Japan, which was never supposed to rearm after World War II, is now rearming. But can you blame them? Would you trust Obama to protect you from China and North Korea? So that's where it's going, folks. American power and prestige is going down and down and down. And that was very evident when your president called for Western support to go into Syria a little while ago. All your allies were lining up, right? Couldn't wait to get involved. Couldn't wait to stand with Mr. Obama. After the great support he gave to Poland and Czechoslovakia by removing their missile shield. After the way he betrayed Georgia, after the way he's betraying Israel now, you wonder why your allies will no longer stand with you. And I'm not saying you should go into Syria, far from it, but it's an indication of where American prestige is going around the world. You know, when the Pope put out a message about Syria recently, he didn't address it to Obama, he addressed it to Vladimir Putin, a lifelong KGB man. He has more prestige now than your president, which is a pretty sad state of affairs. So, you know, there is nowhere to run. You know, I get emails all the time. They say, look, guy, look, if things turn bad in America, can I come down and live in New Zealand? And I say, look, come down, you'll love the place. The people are great. The politics will drive you nuts. But it's a wonderful country. But it isn't a refuge. Nowhere is. Not Costa Rica, not Belize, not anywhere. This is the last stand. This is the final battlefield of freedom. In World War II, your guys went to fight in Europe. Right now, the main battlefield is in Virginia and Ohio and Colorado and Florida, the battleground states. That's where the fate of the Western world is going to be decided. So, my book, The Enemies Within, Communists, Socialists and Progressives in the United States Congress. Now, my first book, Barack Obama and the Enemies Within, was 700 pages. And I got sick of lugging that around. That was pretty heavy. And I promised the next book would be smaller. But the bloody commies just kept on coming. Okay? I couldn't leave out Sheila Jackson Lee, could I? Or Eddie Bernice Johnson. And I almost got one of the Castro brothers in, but maybe for the next time. You know, and I'll talk about those guys later. But, Fidel, well, it's hard to tell the difference, okay? Only two brothers haven't got enough power yet, but if they did, they'd be just like the other ones. Okay, so, The Enemies Within. Now, you'd have to be pretty confident of your case to write a book with a title like that 20 years after the collapse of the Berlin Wall, if you didn't want to be laughed out of the country. I've spent 5 years in libraries all over this country, from South Central LA to Madison, Wisconsin, you know, Seattle, New York, all a liberal, you know, all a liberal dens of iniquity, researching and digging and delving. And it isn't actually hard to find this stuff if you're prepared to look for it. So the book is really about the takeover of the US Congress. It profiles 51 members of Congress, House of Representatives, and 14 senators. And it's about the two big secrets of communism in the modern world. Now, the first secret, I think they borrowed it from the devil, which is not surprising, because we all know the cleverest thing the devil ever did was to convince people he doesn't exist. And what have the communists done in the last 20 years? They faked their own death, exactly, sir. They've convinced most of us they don't exist, and if they do, they aren't a threat. And they've made a lot of headway by doing that. The second big secret of communism, and this is hardly ever written about, if ever, and this is the guts of my book, it is the ability of a tiny Marxist-Leninist party to influence and control the legislative process in their country. Now, in this country, there's approximately 20,000 card-carrying communists. Well, actually, 19,999 after the death of John Stanford this week in San Antonio, the leader of your local communist party. Yeah. But what I'm saying is, those 20,000 are dictating policy in a country of over 300 million people. A very small tail is wagging a very big dog. Now, that sounds a pretty far-fetched claim, and I don't expect you to swallow it, but I just ask you to consider, like, when these guys actually stand for public office occasionally, they get 20 votes or 75 votes, and people laugh at them. How could these people be of any influence whatsoever? But it isn't just the number of votes you get that determine your political influence. There's a man called Al Capone. How many votes did he ever get in Chicago? Telling me he didn't run that city? How many votes does the mafia get in Sicily these days? Telling me they don't run that province? Extortion, backroom deals, indoctrination, subversion, espionage, you know, standover tactics, vote fraud. There's a whole bunch of ways that small groups can control whole countries. And the communists have had more than 80 years of practice at this. This is what they do. 2,000 Bolsheviks took over Russia, a country of 160 million people at the time. They don't need big numbers to have a lot of effect. They have the science of Marxism-Leninism on their side, and that's a very powerful science. The Marxism side is crap, but the Leninism is very, very effective because it's all about gaining power. So, I'm making a point here, but how about some examples? You know, I've got to prove myself. I'm going to give an example from New Zealand first, and I'm sure Blair will have some memories of this, as will Wes. Now, back in 1984, we elected a socialist Labour government. The first thing they did, the most important thing they did, well, they did some economic stuff, but on the foreign policy arena, the first thing they did was to enact a ban on nuclear warships entering our harbours. Now, as your country was the only people ever sending nuclear warships to our harbours, overnight, that destroyed the Australia-New Zealand-United States military alliance, killed it stone cold dead. And it still hasn't been revived to this day. So how could that happen? How could a pro-Western, pro-American country like New Zealand, at the height of the Cold War, so willingly turn its back on the Western alliance? Well, this is how it was done. A few years after that, I had the privilege over several months of interviewing a New Zealander who had infiltrated our local Communist Party, the Socialist Unity Party, for our security intelligence services, the equivalent of your FBI. And in 1983, he was given the greatest honour any communist could enjoy. He and three other comrades were chosen to go to Moscow to study at Lenin's Institute for Higher Learning and Leningradsky Prospect. And that is like going to Mecca for a communist. Now, this was not a small institute. This was 6,500 students at any one time, some of them with one-to-one tutelage, many of them on seven-year courses. This was the training academy of the future world communist leadership. And incidentally, my friend was there just at the time your President Reagan sent troops in to liberate Grenada in the Caribbean. And the Soviets were absolutely spitting tacks. They were livid. They were livid that your bloody Ronald Reagan had shut down what was going to become the second Cuba of the Caribbean. So we have Mr. Reagan to thank for that one, as well as many other things. So these guys were training in Moscow. All of them were taught Russian history to build loyalty to Moscow. They were taught trade union building. They were taught espionage techniques. They were taught racial agitation. But the most important thing they were taught, particularly the Western comrades, was how to take Moscow's policies back to their country and by using the labour unions and the peace movement, make them the policy of the government of the day, of their country. I've just got to backtrack, I've left something out. The big way that the communist change policy in your country is through the use of the labour unions. Now, the labour unions are only 11%, 12% of your workforce, even fewer in a work-to-right state like yours. But if you can control the labour, and in your country you were very lucky because your AFL-CIO was for many years run by anti-communists like Lane Kirkland and George Meany. But in 1995, there was a coup. That year, Democratic Socialists of America, your largest Marxist group, took over the AFL-CIO, and they put their man, John Sweeney, in as president. And now their man, Richard Trumka, their protege, is carrying on the job. Now, what that did was give them control, effectively, of the Democratic Party. Because there's hardly a Democrat elected official at any level in this country who does not owe his job to the labour unions. They rely on the unions for manpower, for money, for people to commit vote fraud for them, whatever. And they know that he who pays the piper calls the tune. If the unions tell them to jump, they jump. If the unions tell them to put forward a certain policy, they put forward that policy. If the unions tell the Democrats to put forward a certain candidate, that's what they do. So the communists set a policy. They make that Labour Union policy, and the Labour Unions, by block voting at Democratic Party conventions and pressuring the representatives, make it Democratic Party policy. So that's how they do it. Now, Moscow 1983, this was the time of the massive anti-nuclear marches through Europe. Hundreds of thousands of Europeans were marching through Rome and Germany and Berlin and Brussels and Paris, waving big ban the bomb signs, get us out of NATO, get America out of Europe, all anti-NATO stuff. And there was a big fear that NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which you guys are the linchpin of, might break up. And of course the Soviets were funding all of this and directing it because they wanted to take NATO down so they could take control of Europe. And I will tell you, back in 1983, as today in 2013, your military is Moscow's number one target. Number one. Because they know if they can take out your military, that will give Russia and China and Iran and all of their allies everything they want, which is basically everything. That's why Putin, despite the little spat over Syria right now, loves Obama like a chocolate. Because he is giving Putin everything he wants. He's destroying your military right before your eyes. And if that goes down far enough, folks, I'll tell you what, your enemies will not sit on their hands and let you rebuild. They will take their chance if it gets bad enough. And you won't be having any allies come to your aid, I can tell you that, on current patterns. So they had this game going on in Europe, but they thought, well, they're subtle, they're chess players. They thought, well, okay, this is going on in Europe. How about we take another country outside of Europe, out of the Western Alliance, and we can use the propaganda value of that to spur on the destruction of NATO. So they chose New Zealand because we're small, progressive, socially liberal, and the communists controlled our unions. They controlled our peace movement, and at that time had heavily infiltrated our Labour Party. But they had a problem. They knew they couldn't sell this as an anti-American thing because New Zealand was too pro-American. And when I say sell, I mean that. If you think American corporations are good at selling and marketing, mass media, marketing, etc., they got nothing on the Russians. They have had 80 years of practice at influencing Western public opinion. They're still at it today with their Russia Today, etc. They have psychologists, they have marketing experts, sociologists. Every country in the world they have mapped out. The religious makeup, the cultural makeup, the sporting events, the whole culture. They know what messages will sell in each country and they tailor it accordingly. So they got these KGB experts, they sat down with this 4-member delegation from New Zealand and they worked out some slogans. This was going to have to be patriotic New Zealand stuff, not anti-American. It was going to have to be Kiwi standing up for peace. New Zealanders standing against the nuclear arms race. Kiwi striking independent foreign policy course. So these four guys went back to New Zealand. They held secret meetings with the Labour Party, even signed a contract with them in the Hotel Workers Union rooms in Marion Street in Wellington. Secret meetings with the unions, the peace movement, they mounted a campaign, and in a few short months, legislation was in front of the New Zealand Parliament, it was signed off, and our alliance with your country was dead. Just like that. The Soviets could not believe how quickly it went. They were overjoyed. And I will tell you, if you talk to any Kiwi today, and now you know what their accents sound like, you know, if you're down at Disney World or something and they all go there, you'll hear some. Say, guys, hey, I hear about this anti-nuclear thing in the 80s. What do you think of that? I say 90% of them will puff out their chests with pride and say, yeah, we did it. We stood up for peace. We were the mouse that roared. Be so proud. And hardly one of them in 4 million people has any idea that those policies they so love, so iconic in New Zealand today, even the Conservatives don't dare touch them, they have no idea that they were designed by the KGB at Lenin's Institute for Higher Learning in Moscow. A whole country was suckered. And that happens all over the Western world on a regular basis. But could it happen in this country? If I'd said that 10 years ago, would you have believed me then? Probably not. Pretty hard to believe in the Bush era, wouldn't it? Okay, I want to give some examples. Now, I want to give a little story, then give first example. Now, are there any Vietnam veterans in the room? Thank you. I knew there would be several. Now, this one may make you a little angry. Okay. A few months ago, your president held a meeting in Washington with the communist premier of Vietnam. With the premier of communist Vietnam. And he made a statement during that meeting that caused some controversy on the conservative blogosphere. Mr. Obama said that Ho Chi Minh, who was the communist leader of Vietnam during the war, was a huge admirer of Thomas Jefferson and the American Constitution. Can you believe that one? Well, it's true, in a way, in a strange way. But the fact that Obama said that, a man who was mentored at the knee of a professional communist propagandist like Frank Marshall Davis, show he would have known the backstory. This was Obama sending a little subtle message to the troops. I'm still on your side, guys, don't worry. Now, the backstory is this. During World War II, Ho Chi Minh, a 20-year veteran of the Communist Party, a man with a lot of blood on his hands, a Stalinist who trained at the Lenin School in Moscow, was fighting the Japanese invaders with his guerrilla army. And he was working with your OSS, your Office of Strategic Services, to do that. That's the forerunner of your CIA. Now, that organisation was heavily infiltrated by communists because Wild Bill Donovan, the man who set it up, deliberately recruited veterans of the Abraham Lincoln Brigades, the American communists who fought for Stalin in the Spanish Civil War, because he wanted people with European military experience. And those people were never fully cleaned out, so your CIA was penetrated from day one. But notice they worked in Spain as the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, not the Karl Marx Brigade or the Vladimir Lenin Brigade or the Joseph Stalin Brigade, just as the communists had an Abraham Lincoln School in Chicago and a Jefferson School in New York. They loved to cloak their revolution under the guise of your revolution. And your president does the same thing today. So Ho Chi Minh got rid of the French, got rid of the Japanese. The next mission was to get rid of the French colonialists who returned after the war. Now Uncle Ho thought, well, FDR doesn't like the French very much. I'm going to get the Americans to help us to get rid of the French too. He wrote letters to FDR asking for help. But he knew he had to get American public opinion on his side. And he couldn't go that if he was going around talking about Marxism-Leninism and the dictatorship of the proletariat. He'd have to talk about Thomas Jefferson and the American Revolution. And that's what he did. Went all round Vietnam doing that. He did a big rally in downtown Hanoi in front of thousands of people, whole bunch of OSS officers. I support Thomas Jefferson. He is the greatest revolutionary leader in history. The American Revolution and the American Constitution is the model for Vietnam. The Bill of Rights, the greatest political document ever written. All designed to suck in American public opinion to get them on side with fighting the French. But FDR died. and Harry Truman, a real Democrat, took over, and he was nowhere near as stupid. He wouldn't have a bar of Ho Chi Minh. Wouldn't have a bar of him. So Ho Chi Minh went openly communist, got the Russians on board, and eventually started the war. Now, just a point too, you know, in those days, Democrats, particularly in the South, were often more conservative than the Republicans. It was the Democrats that set up the House Un-American Activities Committee. It was Harry Truman that Frank Marshall Davis used to call a fascist for his opposition to communism. And it's just a sad thing that today's Democrats still think they're voting for Harry Truman and JFK. They don't realise that when the unions got taken over, so did their party. And Joe Lieberman was the last of the old guard to stand. And where did he go? So Obama also made another statement after that, in that little meeting, which was very significant. He said something like, "Americans have to get on board with helping Vietnam repair the damage done during the war." Now what that means is your taxpayers' money is going to go to Vietnam to repair the damage done by your troops with Agent Orange and bombing. Now, there's a little communist group in this country called the Committees of Correspondence for Democracy and Socialism. See that word democracy to hide what they do? It's a breakaway from the Communist Party USA. Its most famous member is Angela Davis. I'm sure you remember her with the big afro, the murder charges, whatever. Now, their favourite country is Vietnam. They're allied to Vietnam. They're always sending delegations over there. Now, a few years ago, they set up the Vietnam Agent Orange Responsibility Campaign, a front group which was designed to lobby your Congress to make your taxpayers pay reparations to Vietnam for the damage you guys did during that war. Now, I'm a bit old-fashioned, but I sort of thought reparations were what the bad guys paid to the good guys. Isn't that how it used to work? So how come the good guys are now going to be paying reparations to the bad guys who started the war? Now, the Committees of Correspondence has brought a whole bunch of delegations from Vietnam to appear in front of your Congress with sob stories about the effects of Agent Orange and how terrible it is. They've even brought little girls with no legs to sit in front of your Congress to jerk the tears out of your congressmen. The committees has also enlisted the aid of several members of your House of Representatives and several of your senators. Jeff Merkley, Tom Harkin, Al Franken out of Minnesota, John Conyers from Michigan, and you'll be shocked to hear that Sheila Jackson Lee has climbed on board. That'll blow you away. And before he left Congress and became a famous sex pest in San Diego, Bob Filner. Bob Filner was even sent to Vietnam a couple of years ago to negotiate these reparations. He was sent, paid for on the dime of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, an old Soviet front now run by the Cubans. A communist old front paid one of your congressmen to go to a communist country to negotiate reparations from your country to theirs. They've even enlisted that great patriot, Charlie Sheen, to narrate a documentary for them. So they have built this campaign up, and now they've got a bill before your Congress to grant reparations from your country to Vietnam. Now, I know that there are people in this country who are still suffering today from the effects of Agent Orange, many of them living in homeless shelters, some on the streets, many in hospitals, many of them in dire, dire straits, still suffering 40 or 50 years later. Now, there's never enough money for those guys, is there? But your president thinks there's enough money to send to Vietnam to bail out their country, the country that started that war. And it won't even go to the soldiers in Vietnam. It'll go to the Vietnamese government to do with what they see fit. And it won't be something nice, I can assure you. Does that make you angry in any way? I think it should. And that's 300 communists influencing public policy in your country today. And it's all in my book. The whole chapter's called The Vietnam Scam. All the photographs, it's all there. Now what about a bigger example? This one should resonate in Texas. Immigration. Specifically, amnesty for at least 12 million illegal immigrants. And voting rights. Now you've got some people in the GOP like dear old Marco Rubio and John McCain and Lindsey Graham, all your favourites, okay, who tell you that this is going to be good for the Republican Party. Because the Latinos are all going to start voting GOP, right? Just like those 90% of blacks in this country vote, you know, are all going to vote for the GOP after voting Democrat for more than 50 years. Just like the 80% of the Jewish population of this country who have been voting Democrat for more than 100 years are all going to switch. I would suggest that the only reason these people are pushing this line is because they're allied with certain business interests in the Chamber of Commerce who are really, really keen to get cheap labour to run their factories and farms. And I think that's what they're more in love with than your border security or your national integrity. Damn that. Just so those guys can make more money in their factories and farms, make a quick buck, to hell with America's security. Now why do the left want this? Because they're driving this. Why are they putting all their effort into a bill getting amnesty before your Congress? Well, this movement goes back some time. It goes back to California in the 50s. Now there was a man in California then, actually came from San Antonio. His father fought in the Mexican Revolution. He grew up in San Antonio, moved to California as a young man. He was called Bert Corona. Became a Communist Party member, also a leading member of the Democratic Party. He set up the Viva Kennedy Clubs in the 60s, which were the first organized effort to bring Latinos into the Democratic Party. He also set up numerous immigrants' rights organizations all through the Southwest and set up groups to lobby against any attempt to crack down on illegal immigration. He trained hundreds of protégés, three of whom are very prominent today. The first is a man called Gil Cedillo, a hardcore Marxist who was until recently a California state senator. And he got the DREAM Act pushed through in California a couple of years ago, which granted rights to the children of illegal immigrants. Another one of Corona's protégés was Antonio Villagrosa himself, until recently the mayor of L.A. Now, Villagrosa is a hardcore Marxist, went to Cuba as a young man to pick sugar cane for Castro, the Cuban Castros, with the Venceremos Brigades. He made L.A. a sanctuary city by forbidding the LAPD from enforcing immigration laws. And the illegals flooded in, changed the demographics and the whole makeup of that city and Southern California as a whole. The third person in this little triumvirate is Maria Elena Durazzo, the current head of the California labor movement, most powerful woman in that state and another hardcore Marxist. She has led the labor union voting registration drives over the last 15 years to sign up hundreds and thousands of Latino voters. She has changed the voting patterns right through Southern California. And the three of those people working together under Corona's guidance have turned what was once a red-purple state into this one of the bluest states of the union, all through the promotion of immigration and voting registration drives. And that has been a deliberate Marxist ploy. Change that state forever. Even Orange County, once the most conservative region in your country, is now purple. All because of their work. Another man to think about is a guy called Lorenzo Torres. Died last year. An Arizona guy. I would say one of the most successful politicians to come out of that state in decades. And I guarantee most Arizonans have never heard of him. He was the head of the Communist Party USA's Latino Commission. And his job was to coordinate support networks for illegal immigrants across the entire Southwest, from Texas to California, from Arizona to Nevada, New Mexico, the whole lot. He also set up big Latino voting drives and set up campaigns against any crackdowns on illegal immigration. He was the leader behind the anti-SB70 campaign a couple of years ago. He also was the man who basically gave Arizona three Communist Party affiliated members of the House of Representatives currently serving. Arizona, one of the reddest states in the Union, one of the most libertarian, has three Communist Party affiliated Congress members. Raul Grijalva, that'll shock you. Ed Pastor and Kirsten Sinema, the later new freshman, all affiliated to the Communist Party USA. All of them exposed in my book. The third person to consider is still with us today, a man called Eliseo Medina. He's the executive vice president of the SEIU union, the largest union in your country and the one with the biggest Latino membership. He is the leader of the immigrants' rights movement in this country today. He is the reason that bill got before your Senate, and recently he's been organizing rallies outside of Republican congressmen's offices, union rallies all over this country, to pressure Republican reps to put a bill before your Congress in this session. He is a driving force. And he works closely with Grijalva. He works closely with the leader of that movement in the House of Representatives, Luis Gutierrez, a representative from Illinois, a former member of the pro-Cuban Puerto Rican Socialist Party, another Marxist-Leninist in your Congress. Medina has also served on Mr. Obama's Latino Advisory Commission. He's a member of Democratic Socialists of America and a big-time supporter of the Communist Party USA. And to prove a point, which organization, folks, in this country 20 years ago was the most hardcore anti-illegal immigrant organization in the country? Who was lobbying Congress continually to increase penalties for any employer who employed illegal immigrants? The AFL-CIO. Because they saw that illegal immigrants were unfair competition for their members, that they would drive wages and conditions out the bottom. Now, which organization in this country is leading the charge for the legalization of illegal immigrants? The AFL-CIO. Why the change? Well, there was a big change in 95, right? Because before 1995, the AFL-CIO was there to represent the interests of workers. Now, illegal immigrants, but after 1995, it became there to promote Marxist revolution. Because that's when the coup took place. So illegal immigrants are bad for workers, but they are real good for socialist revolution. And that is why the AFL-CIO is today busily selling out their own membership to promote illegal immigration, because they see it as a path to socialist revolution. And the man who organized that about face was Eliseo Medina, because it's not easy to get union members to vote against their own interests. But Eliseo Medina campaigned for several years, and in 2000, I think it was down in Los Angeles at the AFL-CIO's convention that year, they changed the policy under his direction from anti-illegal immigrant to pro-illegal immigrant. And that from that point on, the unions were selling out their members in favour of illegal immigrants. So why do they want this? Well, of course they want more members, but that's not the main reason. Eliseo Medina let the cat out of the bag at a big progressive conference in Washington, D.C. 2 years ago. It's all quoted in my book. He got up in front of the progressives and said, "Our number one priority for this movement is to get an immigration bill passed through your Congress and Senate. We have to give amnesty and voting rights to our illegal, our undocumented workers. And did he talk about compassion or reuniting families or reinvigorating the economy or giving immigrants an even break? Not a bar of it. Not a word. All he talked about was the numbers. Because he said this. In 2008, the Latinos in this country voted 80% for Barack Obama and progressive candidates. If we stand by them now and we get them voting rights and citizenships, they will support us. That will give us at least 8 million more votes for the Democratic Party. That will give us a governing majority, not just for the next few election cycles, but for the foreseeable future. In other words, a Democratic Party, one-party state, led by the Marxists. Because you think about it, folks, they get 8 million more votes. Several million of those will be here. If they get Texas Blue, which they are working on full on now, if they can do to you what they did to California, if they can get the two biggest states in the union to go blue and get the electoral college votes from California and Texas, no matter what they do in the rest of the country, it will be mathematically impossible for the Republicans to ever win another presidential election. It cannot be done. That is why your state is so crucial. That's why they want to take your state blue, and that's why they want amnesty. Nothing to do with compassion. It's all about socialist takeover. And you've got these dumb GOPers, and I won't say they were dumb, I would say they're treacherous, who want to sell you on the idea that this is going to help the GOP. This is going to destroy the GOP, but more than that, it will destroy your country as you know it. And those guys need to be gotten rid of, primed out, post-haste. Okay, another example. Anybody here heard of Obamacare? One or two of you? Good. No, I hope you don't. I'm really hoping you don't, because you've got to stop that immigration bill. You've got to defund Obamacare. Now, why does the left want this? Well, is it to give Auntie Mabel her knee operation? Is it to help the guy in the homeless shelter get cover? It's all about power, folks. And what they refer to, the left refer to this, they go back to Britain in the 1930s. Because at that time, the British working class was very solidly conservative voting. They were pro-king, pro-country, very patriotic. They didn't want a bar of that bloody socialist Labour Party. But after 1946, with the Beveridge Report and the introduction of the National Health Service, that shifted within 10 years the bulk of the British working class behind the socialist Labour Party. Because no matter how bad socialist healthcare is, and I come from a country that has a lot of it, and you probably agree with me, Blair, it ain't so good, is it? It ain't flash. But the thing is, if that's all you've got, you will vote for the party who's going to keep it, not the party who's going to take it away. This is about locking you behind the Democratic Party forever. Because once it's in, it's in. And think about this, you know, there's an argument. Some of these people say, well, look, everybody's going to get coverage, and that's fair, and pre-existing conditions. But okay, the simple argument is this, because they all think the quality is going to be the same. The simple argument is this. In a free market healthcare system, and I know it's not free market here, but at least you have strong elements of it, you are a customer. And are you people in business here, folks? How do you treat your customers? As best you can, right? Build up friendships, relationships. You get repeat business, referrals. That's your lifeblood. But if you've got a socialist system and the budget is this big and everybody's needs have to come out of that, you become a liability. And how do you treat your liabilities, folks? You get rid of them as soon as you can. So if you've got a socialist system and you're a 75-year-old guy with prostate cancer and you need $100,000 worth of chemotherapy to extend your life by 3 or 4 years, and your next-door neighbour who's 25 has got leukemia and he needs $100,000 worth of chemotherapy to save his life, who do you think is going to get the treatment? Well, maybe. But I know who's going to have a better chance. You know, that 75-year-old guy is basically going to be put in a little room in a hospital and given lots of palliative drugs and left to quietly die. Now, Blair may disagree with me, but I think in New Zealand, rationing is just regarded as normal. We don't even see it as rationing. We just know if you're old or infirm, you don't get the same treatment as someone who's young and paying taxes. And if you're a woman in New Zealand and you've got breast cancer, you don't hang around to get the second grade drugs in New Zealand. If you're rich enough, you go to Australia and you pay for it yourself. I could tell you a whole lot of horror stories about our health system. Our government doubled our healthcare budget in 6 years. Hardly a measurable increase in outcomes. A few years ago, they instituted a law because the waiting lists were getting so long. Nobody could be on a waiting list for more than 6 months. Sounds good, doesn't it? But what that meant was, at the end of 6 months, you go back to your GP, and he may put you back on the list, or he may not. That's how they fudge the figures. That's how it works. It can only work by rationing. Now, the father of the single-payer or socialised healthcare movement in this country is a retired Chicago doctor named Quentin Young. Now, the guy's pushing 90 now, and in my darker moments, I wish he'd gone to Britain 15 years ago, because he probably wouldn't be with us now. But he stayed here and enjoyed your system, right? Now, he's set up the Physicians for a National Health Plan, a whole bunch of other organisations, worked inside your AMA, worked with Canadian doctors, worked with congressmen like John Conyers, worked with the unions. He's had single-payer bills in front of your Congress on several occasions. They came close under Hillary, but that failed. But in 2009, with the Affordable Health Care Act, they finally started to make some progress. And it's not surprising that the progress came under Mr. Obama, because for many years in Chicago, Quentin Young was Barack Obama's personal physician. He openly claims credit for indoctrinating Obama into the ideas of socialist healthcare and claims that Obama was a big fan of single payer when he was an Illinois state senator and nobody paid attention to what he said. Now, Quentin Young was also a 40-year veteran of the Communist Party USA until he left that to set up Democratic Socialists of America. So a Marxist indoctrinated Obama into socialist healthcare. And it was DSA, Democratic Socialists of America, that gave you Obamacare through their unions and through the Congressional Progressive Caucus, which they set up, which is 80 strong, the biggest caucus in your Congress. They've promoted this for more than 30 years. And now that they've got Obamacare, they're working hard to make it into single payer. And that's all detailed in my book. I quote them extensively. To prove a point, just before the last election, the Obama campaign put out a little video designed to mock Mitt Romney. They said, "Hey Mitt, guess what? The man who designed Obamacare for us, the architect of it," their words, "John McDonough, Massachusetts state legislator, formerly Harvard academic, he's the man who put it together for us, Mitt. And you know how you hate Obamacare and want to get rid of it? Well, guess what? It was John McDonough that designed Romneycare. So ha ha, Mitt." And it was true, McDonough designed both systems. Romney was presented with a bill from the Massachusetts state legislature, which is shot through with DSA supporters. He pushed it back, tried to modify it, tried to make it less socialist, but it passed and he got stuck with it. But what the Obama campaign video didn't say is that John McDonough is the former head of Boston Democratic Socialists of America. So a Marxist designed Obamacare. A bunch of Marxists promoted it through the unions and your Congress. And another Marxist, all from the same organization, indoctrinated Obama into it. 7,000 members of Democratic Socialists of America, if they're allowed to get away with it, are going to socialize between 1/6 and 1/4 of your economy and change your country for the worse forever. That's how they work. Now, the other thing the book is about, anybody here ever applied for a job with the federal government who's willing to admit it? Okay, I'm not talking about defence, that's all legitimate, and let's say at least 2% of the rest of the federal government is legitimate. Or 1.5, maybe 1. Okay. But did you have to get a security clearance to get that job? An FBI security clearance. Okay. They practically go through your underwear drawers, don't they? Your family background, your childhood associates, your education, foreign travel, political associations, drug habits, the whole lot. They want to know about them. Because they need to trust you. You might be guarding a nuclear base one day. You might have secrets on your desk. You might be guarding the president. You could be in all sorts of positions of trust. And it's fair enough they need to check you out. But what if you stand for what if you put on a suit and tie and stand for Congress or the Senate and you get onto the Science and Technology Committee or the Judiciary Committee or the Armed Services Committee or the Intelligence Committee and you have all secrets going over your desk on a regular basis and you have the power to influence a country of more than 340 million people and indeed the whole Western world, how much security scrutiny do you get then? Big fat zero. Now, you can be a former member of a communist party, have gone down to Cuba more than 6 times like Barbara Lee. You can hang around with the communist party, write for their publication, support Cuba like Eddie Bernice Johnson. You can hang around with the committees of correspondence like Sheila Jackson Lee. You can have a 50-year history with the Communist Party like John Conyers. You can be a former supporter of the Communist Workers' Party, the most violent, militant Maoist party this country has ever seen. 5 of them got shot to death in a gun battle with the KKK in North Carolina in 1979, like that beautifully coiffed, immaculately dressed Judy Chu out of California. You can hang around with the leader of the Connecticut Communist Party like Rosa DeLauro, have a big history with the communists like Nancy Pelosi. You can be a card-carrying member of Democratic Socialists of America like Jerry Nadler or Jan Schakowsky or Danny Davis. You can hang around with the Washington State Communist Party like Senator Patty Murray. You can be a supporter of the Colombian narco-terrorists like Tammy Baldwin. I could go on and on and on. Alan West, your congressman from Florida, he got himself in trouble a couple of years ago when he said there were 80 communists in Congress. He was a bit loose in his terminology. He was also pretty light on the numbers. There's at least 100 members of your House of Representatives and probably 20 of your senators who couldn't pass a basic security test to clean the toilets at any military base in your country. Yet they are running your country. They are at the heart of your government.